Goy, did you even find any?
No, admitted Eddie.
Good, I said. You got lucky.
Why are you so against killing Strigoi? Asked Maya hotly. Isn't that what you train for?
I train for sane missions, not childish stunts like this.
It isn't childish, she cried. They killed my mother, and the Guardians weren't doing anything. Even their information is bad. There weren't any Strigoi in the tunnels, probably none in the whole city.
Christian looked impressed.
You found the tunnels?
Yeah, said Eddie. But like she said, they were useless.
We should see them before we go, Christian told me. It'd be kind of cool. And if the data was bad, there's no danger.
No, I snapped. We're going home now. Mason looked tired.
We're going to search the city again. Even you can't make us go back, Rose.
No, but the school's guardians can when I call and tell them you're here. Call it blackmailing or being a tattletale, the effect was the same. The three of them looked at me like I had just simultaneously gut-punched them all.
You'd really do that? Asked Mason. You'd sell us out like that?
I rubbed my eyes, wondering desperately why I was trying to be the voice of reason here. Where was the girl who'd run away from school? Mason had been right. I had changed. This isn't about selling anyone out. This is about keeping you guys alive.
You think we're that defenseless? Asked Maya.
I rubbed my eyes, wondering desperately why I was trying to be the voice of reason here. Where was the girl who'd run away from school? Mason had been right. I had changed. This isn't about selling anyone out. This is about keeping you guys alive.
You think we're that defenseless? Asked Maya. You think we'd get killed right away?
Yes, I said. Unless you found some way to use water as a weapon. She flushed and didn't say anything.
We brought silver stakes, said Eddie.
Fantastic. They must have stolen them. I looked at Mason pleadingly. Mason, please, call this off. Let's go back. He looked at me for a long time. Finally, he sighed.
Okay.
Eddie and Maya looked aghast, but Mason had assumed a leadership role with them, and they didn't have the initiative to go on without him. Maya seemed to take it the hardest, and I felt bad for her. She'd barely had any real time to grieve for her mother. She just jumped right on board with this revenge thing as a way to cope with the pain. She'd have a lot to deal with when we got back. Christian was still excited about the idea of underground tunnels. Considering he spent all his time in an attic, I shouldn't have been all that surprised.
I saw the schedule, he told me. We've got a while before the next bus.
We can't go walking into some Strigoi lair, I argued, walking toward the mall's entrance.
There are no Strigoi there, said Mason. It's seriously all janitorial stuff. There was no sign of anything weird. I really do think the Guardians had bad information.
Rose, said Christian, let's get something fun out of this. They all looked at me. I felt like a mom who wouldn't buy her kids candy at the grocery store.
Okay, fine. Just a peek, though.
The others led Christian and me to the opposite end of the mall through a door marked Staff Only. We dodged a couple of janitors, then slipped through another door that led us to a set of stairs going down. I had a brief moment of déjà vu, recalling the steps down to Adrian's spa party. Only these stairs were dirtier and smelled pretty nasty. We reached the bottom. It wasn't so much a tunnel as a narrow corridor, lined in grime-caked cement. Ugly fluorescent lights were embedded sporadically along the walls. The passage went off to our left and right. Boxes of ordinary cleaning and electrical supplies sat around.
See? Said Mason. Boring.
I pointed in each direction. What's down there?
Nothing, sighed Maya. We'll show you.
We walked down to the right and found more of the same.
I was starting to agree with the boring assessment when we passed some black writing on one of the walls. I stopped and looked at it. It was a list of letters. D, B, C, O, T, D, V, L, D, Z, S, I. Some had lines and X marks next to them, but for the most part, the message was incoherent. Maya noticed my scrutiny. "It's probably a janitor thing," she said, "or maybe some gang did it."
"Probably," I said, still studying it.
The others shifted restlessly, not understanding my fascination with the jumble of letters. I didn't understand my fascination either, but something in my head tugged at me to stay. Then I got it.
B, for Badika.
Z, for Zeklos. I, for Ivashkov. I stared. The first letter of every royal family's name was there. There were three D names, but based on the order, you could actually read the list as a size ranking. It started with the smaller families, Dragomir, Badika, Kanta, and went all the way up to the giant Ivashkov clan. I didn't understand the dashes and lines beside the letters, but I quickly noticed which names had an X beside them. Badika and Drozdov. I stepped back from the wall. "We have to get out of here," I said. My own voice scared me a little. "Right now." The others looked at me in surprise.
"Why?" asked Eddie. "What's going on?"
"I'll tell you later. We just need to go." Mason pointed in the direction we'd been heading.
"This lets out a few blocks away. It's closer to the station."
I peered down into the dark unknown.
"No,"
I said. "We're going back the way we came." They all looked at me like I was insane as we retraced our steps, but nobody questioned me yet. When we emerged from the mall's front, I breathed a sigh of relief to see that the sun was still out, though it was steadily sinking into the horizon and casting orange and red light onto the buildings. The remaining light would still be enough for us to get back to the bus station before we were really in any danger of seeing Strogoi. And I knew now that there really were Strogoi in Spokane. Dimitri's information had been correct. I didn't know what the list meant, but it clearly had something to do with the attacks. I needed to report it to the other guardians immediately, and I certainly couldn't tell the others what I'd realized until we were safely at the lodge. Mason was likely to go back into the tunnels if he knew what I did. Most of our walk back to the station proceeded in silence. I think my mood had cowed the others. Even Christian seemed to have run out of snide comments. Inside, my emotions swirled, oscillating between anger and guilt as I kept re-examining my role in everything. Ahead of me, Eddie stopped walking, and I nearly ran into him. He looked around.
"Where are we?"
Snapping out of my own thoughts, I surveyed the area too. I didn't remember these buildings.
"Damn it!" I exclaimed. "Are we lost? Didn't anyone keep track of which way we went?"
It was an unfair question, since I clearly hadn't paid attention either, but my temper had pushed me past reason. Mason studied me for a few moments, then pointed.
"This way."
We turned and walked down a narrow street between two buildings. I didn't think we were going the right way, but I didn't really have a better idea. I also didn't want to stand around debating. We hadn't gone very far when I heard the sound of an engine and squealing tires. Maya was walking in the middle of the road, and protective conditioning kicked in before I even saw what was coming. Grabbing her, I jerked her out of the street and up against one of the building walls. The boys had done the same. A large gray van with tinted windows had rounded the corner and was headed in our direction. We pressed flat against the wall, waiting for it to go past. Only it didn't. Screeching to a halt, it stopped right in front of us, and the doors slid open. Three big guys spilled out, and again, my instincts kicked in. I had no clue who they were or what they wanted, but they clearly weren't friendly. That was all I needed to know. One of them moved toward Christian, and I struck out and punched him. The guy barely staggered, but was clearly surprised to have felt it at all, I think. He probably hadn't expected someone as small as me to be much of a threat. Ignoring Christian, he moved toward me. In my peripheral vision, I saw Mason and Eddie squaring off with the other two. Mason had actually pulled out his stolen silver stake. Maya and Christian stood there, frozen. Our attackers were relying a lot on bulk. They didn't have the sort of background we had in offensive and defensive techniques. Plus, they were human, and we had Dampier's strength. Unfortunately, we also had the disadvantage of being cornered against the wall. We had nowhere to retreat to. Most importantly, we had something to lose. Like Maya. The guy who'd been sparring with Mason seemed to realize this. He backed off from Mason and instead grabbed her. I barely saw the flash of his gun before its barrel was pressed against her neck. Backing off from my own adversary, I yelled at Eddie to stop. We'd all been trained to respond instantly to those kinds of orders, and he halted his attack, glancing at me questioningly. When he saw Maya, his face went pale. I wanted nothing more than to keep pummeling these men, whoever they were, but I couldn't risk this guy hurting Maya. He knew it, too. He didn't even have to make the threat. He was human, but he knew enough about us to know that we'd go out of our way to protect the Maroi. Novices had a saying grilled into us from an early age. Only they matter. Everyone stopped and looked between him and me. Apparently, we were the acknowledged leaders here. "What do you want?" I asked harshly. The guy pressed his gun closer to Maya's neck, and she whimpered. For all her talk about fighting, she was smaller than me, and not nearly as strong, and she was too terrified to move. The man inclined his head toward the van's open door. "I want you to get inside, and don't start anything. You do, and she's gone." I looked at Maya, the van, my other friends, and then back to the guy. Shit. Chapter 19. I hate being powerless, and I hate going down without a fight. What had taken place outside in the alley hadn't been a real fight. If it had, if I'd been beaten into submission, well, yeah, maybe I could accept that. Maybe. But I hadn't been beaten. I'd barely gotten my hands dirty. Instead, I'd gone quietly. Once they had us sitting on the floor of the van, they'd bound each of our hands behind our back with flex cuffs, strips of plastic that cinched together and held just as well as anything made of metal. After that, we rode in near silence. The men occasionally murmured something to each other, speaking too softly for any of us to hear. Christian or Maya might have been able to understand the words, but they were in no position to communicate anything to the rest of us. Maya looked as terrified as she had out on the street, and while Christian's fear had rapidly given way to his typical haughty anger, even he didn't dare act out with guards nearby. I was glad for Christian's self-control. I didn't doubt any of these men would smack him if he got out of line, and neither I nor the other novices were in a position to stop them. That was what really drove me crazy. The instinct to protect Maroi was so deeply ingrained in me that I couldn't even pause to worry about myself. Christian and Maya were the focus. They were the ones I had to get out of this mess. And how had this mess started? Who were these guys? That was the mystery. They were human, but I didn't believe for an instant that a group of Dampiers and Maroi had been random kidnapping victims. We'd been targeted for a reason. Our captors made no attempts to blindfold us or conceal our route, which I didn't take as a good sign. Did they think we didn't know the city well enough to retrace our steps? Or did they figure it didn't matter, since we wouldn't be leaving wherever they were taking us? All I sensed was that we were driving away from downtown, off toward a more suburban area. Spokane was as dull as I'd imagined. Unlike where pristine white snow lay in drifts, slushy gray puddles lined the streets and dirty patches dotted the lawns. There were also a lot fewer evergreen trees than I was used to. The scraggly, leafless, deciduous trees here seemed skeletal by comparison. They only added to the mood of impending doom. After what felt like less than an hour, the van turned down a quiet cul-de-sac, and we drove up to a very ordinary, yet large, house. Other houses, identical in the way suburban homes often are, stood nearby, which gave me hope. Maybe we could get some help from the neighbors. We pulled inside the garage, and once the door was back down, the men ushered us into the house. It looked a lot more interesting on the inside. Antique, claw-footed sofas and chairs, a large saltwater fish tank, swords crossed over the fireplace, one of those stupid modern art paintings that consisted of a few lines splayed across the canvas. The part of me that enjoyed destroying things would have liked to study the swords in detail, but the main floor wasn't our destination. Instead, we were led down a narrow flight of stairs, down to a basement as large as the floor above. Only, unlike the main floor's open space, the basement was sectioned off into a series of halls and closed doors. It was like a rat's maze. Our captors led us through it without hesitation, into a small room with a concrete floor and unpainted drywall. The furniture inside consisted of several very uncomfortable-looking wooden chairs with slatted backs, backs that proved to be a convenient place for rebinding our hands. The men seated us in such a way that Maya and Christian sat on one side of the room, and the rest of us dampiers sat on the other. One guy, the leader apparently, watched carefully as one of his henchmen bound Eddie's hands with new flex cuffs.
"These are the ones you especially have to watch," he warned, nodding toward us. "They'll fight back."
His eyes traveled first to Eddie's face, then Mason's, and then mine. The guy and I held each other's gaze for several moments, and I scowled. He looked back over at his associate.
"Watch her, in particular."
When we'd been restrained to his satisfaction, he barked out a few more orders to the others and then left the room, shutting the door loudly behind him. His steps echoed through the house as he walked upstairs. Moments later, silence fell. We sat there, staring at each other. After several minutes, Maya whimpered and started to speak.
"What are you going to—"
"Shut up,"
growled one of the men. He took a warning step toward her. Blanching, she cringed but still looked as though she might say something else. I caught her eye and shook my head. She stayed silent, eyes wide, and a slight tremble to her lip. There's nothing worse than waiting and not knowing what'll happen to you. Your own imagination can be crueler than any captor. Since our guards wouldn't talk to us or tell us what was in store, I imagined all sorts of horrible scenarios. The guns were the obvious threat, and I found myself pondering what a bullet would feel like. Painful, presumably. And where would they shoot? Through the heart? Or the head? Quick death. But somewhere else, like the stomach? That would be slow and painful. I shuddered at the thought of my life bleeding out of me. Thinking of all that blood put me in mind of the Badika house and maybe having her throat slit. These men could have knives as well as guns. Of course, I had to wonder why we were still alive at all. Clearly, they wanted something from us. But what? They weren't asking for information, and they were human. What would humans want with us? Usually, the most we feared from humans was either running into crazy slayer types or those who wanted to experiment on us. These seemed like neither. So what did they want? Why were we here? Over and over, I imagined more awful, gruesome fates.
The looks on my friends' faces showed I wasn't the only one who could envision creative torments. The smell of sweat and fear filled the room. I lost track of time and was suddenly jolted out of my imaginings when footsteps sounded on the stairs. The lead captor stepped into the hall. The rest of the men straightened up, tension crackling around them. Oh, God. This was it, I realized. This was what we'd been waiting for.
Yes, sir, I heard the leader say. They're in here, just like you wanted.
Finally, I realized. The person behind our kidnapping. Panic shot through me. I had to escape.
Let us out of here,
I yelled, straining at my bindings.
Let us out of here, you son of a...
I stopped. Something inside me shriveled up. My throat went dry. My heart wanted to stop. The guard had returned with a man and a woman I didn't recognize. I did, however, recognize that they were... Strogoi. Real, live, well, figuratively speaking, Strogoi. It all suddenly clicked together. It wasn't just the Spokane reports that had been true. What we'd feared, Strogoi working with humans, had come true. This changes everything. Daylight wasn't safe anymore. None of us were safe anymore. Worse, I realized these must be the rogue Strogoi, the ones who had attacked the two Maroi families with human help. Again, those horrible memories came to me. Bodies and blood everywhere. Bile rose in my throat, and I tried to shift my thoughts from the past to the present situation. Not that that was any more reassuring. Maroi had pale skin, the kind of skin that blushed and burned easily. But these vampires, their skin was white, chalky in a way that made it look like the result of a bad makeup job. The pupils of their eyes had a red ring around them, driving home what monsters they were. The woman, actually, reminded me of Natalie, my poor friend whose father had convinced her to turn Strogoi. It took me a few moments to figure out what the resemblance was, because they looked nothing alike. This woman was short, probably human before becoming Strogoi, and had brown hair with a bad highlighting job. Then it hit me. This Strogoi was a new one, much as Natalie had been. It didn't become obvious until I compared her with the Strogoi man. The Strogoi woman's face had a little life in it, but his was the face of death. His face was completely devoid of any sort of warmth or gentler emotion. His expression was cold and calculating, laced with malicious amusement. He was tall as Dimitri, and had a slender frame that indicated he'd been Maroi before changing over. Shoulder-length black hair framed his face and stood out against the bright scarlet of his dress shirt. His eyes were so dark and brown that without the red ring, it would have been almost impossible to tell where people ended and Iris began. One of the guards shoved me hard, even though I'd been silent. He glanced up at the Strogoi man.
You want me to gag her?
I suddenly realized I'd been hunching into the back of my chair, unconsciously trying to get as far away from him as possible. He realized this too, and a thin, toothless smile crossed his lips.
No,
he said. His voice was silky and low.
I'd like to hear what she has to say.
He raised an eyebrow at me.
Please, continue.
I swallowed.
No? Nothing to add?
Well, do feel free to pipe up if something else comes to mind. Isaiah! Exclaimed the woman. Why are you keeping them here? Why haven't you just contacted the others?
Elena, Elena,
Isaiah murmured to her. Behave yourself. I'm not going to pass up the chance to enjoy myself with two Maroi and... He walked behind my chair and lifted my hair, making me shudder. A moment later, he peered at Mason and Eddie's necks as well.
Three unblooded dampiers.
He spoke those words with an almost happy sigh, and I realized he'd been looking for guardian tattoos. Strolling over to Maya and Christian, Isaiah rested a hand on his hip as he studied them. Maya could only meet his eyes for an instant before looking away. Christian's fear was palpable, but he managed to return the Strigoi's scrutiny. It made me proud.
Look at these eyes, Elena.
Elena walked over and stood beside Isaiah as he spoke.
That pale blue, like ice.
Like aquamarines.
You almost never get that outside of the royal houses. Badikas, Ozeras,
the occasional Zeklos.
Ozera,
said Christian, trying very hard to sound fearless. Isaiah tilted his head.
Really?
Surely not.
He leaned closer to Christian.
But the age is right. And that hair.
He smiled.
Lucas and Moira's son?
Christian said nothing, but the confirmation on his face was obvious.
I knew your parents. Great people. Unparalleled.
Their deaths were a shame, but,
well, I dare say they brought that on themselves.
I told them they shouldn't have gone back for you.
Would have been wasteful to awaken you so young. They claimed they were going to just keep you around and waken you when you were older. I warned them that that would be a disaster, but,
well.
He gave a delicate shrug. Awaken was the term Strigoi used among themselves when they changed over. It sounded like a religious experience.
They wouldn't listen, and disaster met them in a different way.
Hatred, deep and dark, boiled behind Christian's eyes. Isaiah smiled again.
It's quite touching that you should find your way to me after all this time. Perhaps I can realize their dream after all.
Isaiah, said the woman, Elena, again.
Every word out of her mouth seemed like a whine.
Call the others.
Stop giving me orders.
Isaiah grabbed her shoulder and shoved her away, except that the push knocked her across the room and almost through the wall. She just barely threw her hand out in time to stop the impact. Strigoi had better reflexes than Dampier's, or even Moroi. Her lack of grace meant he'd completely caught her off guard. And really, he'd barely touched her. The push had been light, yet it had packed the force of a small car. This further enforced my belief that he was in another class altogether. His strength beat hers by magnitudes. She was like a fly he could swat away. Strigoi power increased with age, as well as through the consumption of Moroi blood and, to a lesser extent, Dampier blood. This guy wasn't just old, I realized. He was ancient, and he'd drunk a lot of blood over the years. Terror filled Elena's features, and I could understand her fear. Strigoi turned against each other all the time. He could have ripped her head off if he wanted. She cowered, averting her eyes.
I'm sorry, Isaiah.
Isaiah smoothed his shirt, not that it had been wrinkled. His voice took on the cold pleasantness he'd affected earlier.
You clearly have opinions here, Elena, and I welcome you voicing them in a civilized manner.
What do you think we should do with these cubs?
You should, that is, I think we should just take them now,
especially the Moroi.
She was clearly working hard not to whine again and annoy him. Unless you aren't going to throw another dinner party, are you? It's a complete waste. We'll have to share, and you know the others won't be grateful. They never are.
I'm not making a dinner party out of them, he declared loftily.
Dinner party?
But I'm not killing them yet, either. You're young, Elena. You only think about immediate gratification. When you're as old as me, you won't be so impatient.
She rolled her eyes when he wasn't looking. Turning, he swept his gaze over me, Mason, and Eddie.
You three, I'm afraid, are going to die. There's no avoiding it.
I'd like to say I'm sorry, but, well, I'm not. Such is the way of the world. You do have a choice in how you die, however, and that will be dictated by your behavior.
His eyes lingered on me. I didn't really get why everyone seemed to be singling me out as the troublemaker here. Well, maybe I did.
Some of you will die more painfully than others.
I didn't need to see Mason and Eddie to know their fear mirrored mine. I was pretty sure I even heard Eddie whimper. Isaiah abruptly turned on his heels, military style, and faced Maya and Christian.
You two fortunately have options. Only one of you will die. The other will live on in glorious immortality. I'll even be kind enough to take you under my wing until you're a little older. Such is my charity.
I couldn't help it. I choked on a laugh. Isaiah spun around and stared at me. I fell silent and waited for him to throw me across the room like he had Elena. But he did nothing else but stare. It was enough. My heart raced, and I felt tears brim in my eyes. My fear shamed me. I wanted to be like Dimitri, maybe even like my mother. After several long, agonizing moments, Isaiah turned back to the Maroi.
Now, as I was saying, one of you will be awakened and live forever. But it will not be me who wakens you. You will choose to be awakened willingly.
Not likely, said Christian.
He packed as much snarky defiance as he could manage into those two words, but it was still obvious to everyone else in the room that he was scared out of his mind.
Oh, how I love the Ozera spirit, mused Isaiah.
He glanced at Maya, his red eyes gleaming. She shrank back in fear.
But don't let him upstage you, my dear. There's strength in common blood, too. And here's how it will be decided.
He pointed at us Dampiers. His gaze chilled me all over, and I imagined I could smell the stink of decay.
If you want to live, all you have to do is kill one of these three.
He turned back to the Maroi.
That's it. Not unpleasant at all. Just tell one of these gentlemen here you want to do it. They'll release you. Then you drink from them and are awakened as one of us. Whoever does this first walks free. The other will be dinner for Elena and me.
Silence hung in the room.
No, said Christian. No way am I killing one of my friends. I don't care what you do. I'll die first.
Isaiah waved a dismissive hand.
Easy to be brave when you aren't hungry. Go a few days, without any other sustenance, and yes, these three will start to look very good. And they are. Dampiers are delicious. Some prefer them to Maroi, and while I myself have never shared such beliefs, I can certainly appreciate the variety.
Christian scowled.
Don't believe me?
Asked Isaiah.
Then let me prove it.
He walked back over to my side of the room. I realized what he was going to do and spoke without fully thinking things through.
Use me, I blurted out. Drink from me.
Isaiah's smug look faltered for a moment, and his eyebrows rose.
You're volunteering?
I've done it before. Let Maroi feed off me, I mean. I don't mind. I like it. Leave the rest of them alone.
Rose! Exclaimed Mason.
I ignored him and looked beseechingly at Isaiah. I didn't want him to feed off me. The thought made me sick. But I had given blood before, and I'd rather him take pints from me before he touched Eddie or Mason. I couldn't read his expression as he sized me up. For half a second, I thought he might go for it. But instead, he shook his head.
No, not you. Not yet.
He walked over and stood before Eddie. I pulled against my flex cuffs so hard that they dug painfully into my skin. They didn't give.
No, leave him alone.
Quiet,
snapped Isaiah without looking at me. He rested one hand on the side of Eddie's face. Eddie trembled and had gone so pale I thought he would faint.
I can make this easy, or I can make it hurt. Your silence will encourage the former.
I wanted to scream, wanted to call Isaiah all sorts of names and make all sorts of threats, but I couldn't. My eyes flicked around the room, searching for exits, as I had so many times before. But there were none, just blank, bare, white walls. No windows. The one precious door always guarded. I was helpless, just as helpless as I'd been from the moment they'd pulled us into the van. I felt like crying, more from frustration than fear. What kind of guardian would I be if I couldn't protect my friends? But I stayed quiet, and a look of satisfaction crossed Isaiah's face. The fluorescent lighting gave his skin a sickly, grayish hue, emphasizing the dark circles under his eyes. I wanted to punch him.
Good.
He smiled at Eddie and held his face so that the two made direct eye contact.
Now, you won't fight me, will you?
As I've mentioned, Lyssa was good at compulsion, but she couldn't have done this. In seconds, Eddie was smiling.
No, I won't fight you. Good, repeated Isaiah. And you'll give me your neck freely, won't you?
Of course, replied Eddie, tilting his head back. Isaiah brought his mouth down, and I looked away, trying to focus on the threadbare carpet instead. I didn't want to see this. I heard Eddie emit a soft, happy moan. The feeding itself was relatively quiet. No slurping or anything like that.
There.
I glanced back when I heard Isaiah speak again. Blood dripped from his lips, and he ran his tongue across them. I couldn't see the wound on Eddie's neck, but I suspected it was bloody and horrible, too. Maya and Christian stared wide-eyed, both with fear and fascination. Eddie gazed off in a happy, drugged haze, high from both the endorphins and the compulsion. Isaiah straightened up and smiled at the Maroi licking the last of the blood off his lips.
You see,
he told them, moving toward the door.
It's just that easy.
Chapter 20. We needed an escape plan, and we needed it fast. Unfortunately, my only ideas called for things that really weren't under my control, like us being left completely alone so we could sneak off, or having stupid guards whom we could easily fool and slip away from. At the very least, we should have been sloppily secured so that we could break free. None of that was happening, though. After almost 24 hours, our situations hadn't really changed. We were still prisoners, still securely bound. Our captors stayed vigilant, almost as efficient as any group of guardians. Almost. The closest we got to freedom was heavily supervised and extremely embarrassing bathroom breaks. The men gave us no food or water. That was rough on me, but the human and vampire mix made Dampiers hardy. I could handle being uncomfortable, even though I was fast reaching a point where I would have killed for a cheeseburger and some really, really greasy fries. For Maya and Christian, well, things were a little harder. Maroi could go weeks without food and water if they were still getting blood. Without blood, they could manage a few days before getting sick and weak, so long as they still had other sustenance. That was how Lyssa and I had managed while living on our own, since I hadn't been able to feed her every day. Take away food, blood, and water, and Maroi endurance dropped through the floor. I was hungry, but Maya and Christian were ravenous. Already their faces looked gaunt, their eyes almost feverish. Isaiah made matters worse during his subsequent visits. Each time he would come down and ramble on in his annoying, taunting way. Then, before leaving, He'd take another drink from Eddie. By the third visit, I could practically see Maya and Christian salivating. Between the endorphins and lack of food, I was pretty sure Eddie didn't even know where we were. I couldn't really sleep under these conditions, but during the second day, I started nodding off now and then. Starvation and exhaustion will do that to you. At one point, I actually dreamed. Surprising, since I didn't really think I could fall into a deep slumber under such insane conditions. In the dream, and I knew perfectly well that it was a dream, I stood on a beach. It took me a moment to recognize just which beach it was. It was along the Oregon coast, sandy and warm, with the Pacific unfolding in the distance. Lyssa and I had traveled out here once when we lived in Portland. It had been a gorgeous day, but she couldn't handle being out in that much sun. We'd kept the visit short as a result, but I'd always wished I could have stayed longer and basked in all that. Now I had all the light and warmth I could want.
"Little Dampier," said a voice behind me. "It's about time."
I turned around in surprise and found Adrian Ivashkov watching me. He had on khakis and a loose shirt, and in a surprisingly casual style for him, wore no shoes. Wind ruffled his brown hair, and he kept his hands stuffed in his pockets as he regarded me with that trademark smirk of his.
"Still got your protection," he added.
Frowning, I thought for a moment he was staring at my chest. Then I realized his eyes were on my stomach. I had on jeans and a bikini top, and once again, the little blue eye pendant dangled from my belly button. The tchotchke was on my wrist.
"And you're in the sun again," I said. "So I suppose it's your dream?"
"It's our dream."
I wiggled my toes in the sand. "How can two people share a dream?"
"People share dreams all the time, Rose."
I looked up at him with a frown. "I need to know what you mean, about there being darkness around me. What does it mean?"
"Honestly, I don't know. Everyone has light around them, except for you. You have shadows. You take them from Lyssa."
My confusion grew. "I don't understand."
"I can't get into it right now," he told me. "That's not why I'm here."
"You're here for a reason?"
I asked, my eyes wandering to the blue-gray water. It was hypnotic.
"You aren't just here to be here?"
He stepped forward and caught my hand, forcing me to look up at him. All amusement was gone. He was dead serious.
"Where are you?"
"Here," I said, puzzled. "Just like you."
Adrian shook his head.
"No, that's not what I mean. In the real world, where are you?"
"The real world?" Around us, the beach suddenly blurred, like a film going out of focus. Moments later, everything steadied itself. I racked my brain. The real world. Images came to me. Chairs. Guards. Flex cuffs. "In a basement," I said slowly. Alarm suddenly shattered the beauty of the moment as everything came back to me.
"Oh, God, Adrian, you've got to help Maya and Christian. I can't..."
Adrian's grip on my hand tightened.
"Where?"
The world shimmered again, and this time it didn't refocus. He swore.
"Where are you, Rose?"
The world began to disintegrate. Adrian began to disintegrate.
"A basement. In a house. In..."
He was gone. I woke up. The sound of the room's door opening startled me back to reality. Isaiah swept in with Elena in tow. I had to fight a sneer when I saw her. He was arrogant and mean and all around evil. But he was that way because he was a leader. He had the strength and power to back up his cruelty, even if I didn't like it. But Elena? She was a lackey. She threatened us and made snide comments, but most of her ability to do so came from being his sidekick. She was a total suck-up.
"Hello, children," he said,
How are we doing today?
Sullen glares answered him. He strolled over to Maya and Christian, hands folded behind his back.
Any changes of heart since my last visit?
You're taking an awfully long time, and it's upsetting Elena. She's very hungry, you see, but I suspect not as hungry as you two.
Christian narrowed his eyes.
Fuck off,
he said through gritted teeth. Elena snarled and lunged forward.
Don't you dare!
Isaiah waved her off.
Leave him alone. It just means we wait a little longer. And really, it's an entertaining wait.
Elena's eyes shot daggers at Christian.
Honestly, continued Isaiah, watching Christian.
I can't decide which I want more. To kill you, or have you join us?
Either option offers its own amusements.
Don't you get tired of hearing yourself talk?
Asked Christian.
Isaiah considered.
No, not really.
And I don't get tired of this, either.
He turned around and walked toward Eddie. Poor Eddie could barely sit upright in his chair anymore after all the feedings he'd gone through. Worse, Isaiah didn't even need to use compulsion. Eddie's face simply lit up with a stupid grin, eager for the next bite. He was as addicted as a feeder. Anger and disgust flooded through me.
Damn it!
I yelled.
Leave him alone!
Isaiah glanced back at me.
Be silent, girl. I don't find you nearly as amusing as I do Mr. O'Zara.
Yeah?
I snarled.
If I piss you off so much, then use me to prove your stupid point. Bite me instead. Put me in my place and show me what a badass you are.
No,
exclaimed Mason.
Use me.
Isaiah rolled his eyes.
Good God, what a noble lot. You're all Spartacus, aren't you?
He strolled away from Eddie and put a finger under Mason's chin, tilting his head up.
But you, Isaiah said, don't really mean it. You only offer because of her.
He released Mason and walked in front of me, staring down with those black, black eyes.
And you. I didn't really believe you at first either, but now.
He knelt down so he was at my height. I refused to look away from his eyes, even though I knew that put me at risk of compulsion.
I think you really mean it.
And it's not all nobility, either.
You do want it.
You really have been bitten before.
His voice was magical, hypnotic. He wasn't using compulsion exactly, but he definitely had an unnatural charisma surrounding him. Like Lyssa and Adrian, I hung on his every word.
Lots of times, I'd guess, he added.
He leaned toward me, breath hot against my neck. Somewhere beyond him, I could hear Mason shouting something, but all of my focus was on how close Isaiah's teeth were to my skin. In the last few months, I'd only been bitten once, and that was when Lyssa had had an emergency. Before then, she'd bitten me at least twice a week for 2 years, and I had only recently come to realize how addicted to that I'd been. There is nothing, nothing in the world like a Moroi bite, like the flood of bliss it sends into you. Of course, by all accounts, Strigoi bites were even more powerful. I swallowed, suddenly aware of my own heavy breathing and racing heart. Isaiah gave a low chuckle.
Yes. You're a blood whore in the making. Unfortunate for you, because I'm not going to give you what you want.
He backed away, and I slumped forward in my chair. Without further delay, he returned to Eddie and drank. I couldn't watch, but it was because of envy this time, not disgust. Longing burned inside me. I ached for that bite, ached for it with every nerve in my body. When Isaiah finished,
He started to leave the room, then paused. He directed his words at Maya and Christian.
Don't delay, he warned. Seize your opportunity to be saved.
He tilted his head toward me.
You even have a willing victim.
He left. Across the room, Christian met my eyes. Somehow, his face looked even gaunter than it had a couple of hours ago. Hunger burned in his gaze, and I knew I wore the complimentary one, a desire to sate that hunger. God, we were so screwed. I think Christian realized it at the same time. His lips twisted into a bitter smile.
You never looked so good, Rose,
he managed, just before the guards told him to shut up. I dozed a little throughout the day, but Adrian didn't return to my dreams. Instead, while hovering just at the edge of consciousness, I found myself slipping into a familiar territory. Lys's head. After all the weirdness of these last 2 days, being in her mind felt like a homecoming. She was in one of the lodge's banquet rooms, only it was empty. She sat on the floor of the far side of it, trying to stay inconspicuous. Nervousness filled her. She was waiting for something, or rather, someone. A few minutes later, Adrian slipped in.
Cousin,
he said by way of greeting. He sat down beside her and drew his knees up, unconcerned about his expensive dress pants. Sorry I'm late.
It's okay, she said.
You didn't know I was here until you saw me, did you?
She shook her head, disappointed. I felt more confused than ever.
And sitting with me, you can't really notice anything?
No. He shrugged.
Well, hopefully it'll come soon.
How does it look for you? She asked, burning with curiosity.
Do you know what auras are?
They're like bands of light around people, right? Some New Age thing.
Something like that. Everyone has a sort of spiritual energy that radiates out from them. Well, almost everyone.
His hesitation made me wonder if he was thinking of me and the darkness I allegedly walked in.
Based on the color and appearance, you can tell a lot about a person. Well, if anyone could actually see auras, that is.
And you can? She said. And you can tell I use spirit for my aura?
Yours is mostly gold, like mine. It'll shift with other colors depending on the situation, but the gold always stays.
How many other people out there like us do you know?
Not many. I just see them every once in a while. They kind of keep to themselves. You're the first I've actually ever talked to. I didn't even know it was called spirit. Wish I'd known about this when I didn't specialize. I just figured I was some kind of freak.
Lyssa held up her arm and stared, willing herself to see the light shining around it. Nothing. She sighed and let the arm drop. And that's when I got it. Adrian was a spirit user, too. That was why he'd been so curious about Lyssa. Why he'd wanted to talk to her and ask her about the bond and her specialization. It also explained a lot of other things, like that charisma I couldn't seem to escape when I was near him. He'd used compulsion that day Lyssa and I had been in his room. That was how he'd forced Dimitri to release him.
So, they finally let you go?
Adrian asked her.
Yeah, they finally decided I really didn't know anything.
Good,
he said. He frowned, and I realized he was sober for a change.
And you're sure you don't?
I already told you that. I can't make the bond work that way.
Well, you've got to.
She glared. What? You think I'm holding back? If I could find her, I would.
I know. But to have it all, you must have a strong connection. Use that to talk to her in her dreams. I tried, but I can't hang on long enough to...
What did you say?
Exclaimed Lyssa.
Talk to her in her... Dreams?
Now he looked puzzled. Sure. Don't you know how to do that?
No, are you kidding? How is that even possible?
My dreams. I remembered Lyssa talking about unexplained Moroi phenomena, how there might be spirit powers out there beyond healing, things no one even knew about yet. It would appear that Adrian being in my dreams was no coincidence. He'd managed to get inside my head. Maybe in a way similar to how I saw Lyssa's mind. The thought made me uneasy. Lyssa could barely even grasp it. He ran a hand through his hair and tipped his head back, staring at the crystal chandelier above as he pondered.
Okay, so you don't see auras, and you don't talk to people in dreams. What do you do?
I can heal people. Animals. Plants, too. I can bring dead things back to life.
Really?
He looked impressed.
Okay. You get credit for that. What else?
I can use compulsion.
We can all do that.
No. I can really do it. It's not hard. I can make people do anything I want. Even bad things.
So can I.
His eyes lit up.
I wonder what would happen if you tried to use it on me.
She hesitated and absent-mindedly ran her fingers over the textured red carpet. Well, I can't.
You just said you could.
I can, just not right now. I take this prescription for depression and other stuff, and it cuts me off from the magic.
He threw his arms up in the air.
How can I teach you to walk through dreams, then? How else are we going to find Rose?
Look, she said angrily. I don't want to take the meds, but when I was off them, I did really crazy stuff, dangerous stuff. That's what spirit does to you.
I don't take anything. I'm okay,
he said. No, he wasn't, I realized. Lyssa realized it, too.
You got really weird that day when Dimitri was in your room, she pointed out. You started rambling, and you didn't make any sense.
Oh, that? Yeah, it happens now and then, but seriously not often, once a month if that.
He sounded sincere. Lyssa stared at him, suddenly reevaluating everything. What if Adrian could do it? What if he could use spirit without pills and without any harmful side effects? It would be everything she had been hoping for. Besides, she wasn't even sure if the pills would keep working anymore. He smiled, guessing what she was thinking.
What do you say, cousin?
He asked. He didn't need to use compulsion. His offer was plenty tempting in its own right.
I can teach you everything I know if you're able to touch the magic. It'll take a while for the pills to get out of your system. But once they do...
Chapter 21.
This was so not what I needed right now. I could have handled anything else Adrian did. Hitting on her, getting her to smoke his ridiculous cigarettes, whatever. But not this. Lyssa quitting those pills was exactly what I'd wanted to avoid. Reluctantly, I pulled out of her head and returned to my own grim situation. I would have liked to see what further developed with Adrian and Lyssa, but watching them would do no good.
Okay, I really needed a plan now. I needed action. I needed to get us out of here.
But glancing around me, I found myself no closer to escape than I had been earlier, and I spent the next few hours brooding and speculating. We had 3 guards today. They looked a little bored, but not enough to slack off. Nearby, Eddie appeared unconscious, and Mason stared blankly at the floor. Across the room, Christian glared at nothing in particular, and I think Maya was sleeping. Painfully aware of how dry my throat was, I almost laughed in recalling how I told her water magic was useless. It might not do much in a fight, but I would have given anything for her to summon up some. Magic. Why hadn't I thought of this before? We weren't helpless.
Not entirely.
A plan slowly coalesced in my mind. A plan that was probably insane, but was also the best we had. My heart thudded with anticipation, and I immediately schooled my features to calmness before the guards noticed my sudden insight. On the opposite side of the room, Christian was watching me. He'd seen the brief flare of excitement and realized I'd thought of something. He watched me curiously, as ready for action as I was.
God, how could we pull this off? I needed his help, but I had no real way of letting him know what I had in mind. In fact, I wasn't even sure if he could help me at all. He was pretty weak.
I held his gaze, willing him to understand that something was going to happen. There was confusion on his face, but it was paired with determination. After making sure none of the guards were looking directly at me, I shifted slightly, giving a small tug at my wrists. I glanced behind me as much as I could, then met Christian's eyes again. He frowned, and I repeated the gesture.
"Hey,"
I said loudly. Maya and Mason both jerked in surprise.
"Are you guys really going to keep starving us? Can't we at least have some water or something?"
"Shut up," said one of the guards.
It was a pretty standard answer whenever any of us spoke.
"Come on,"
I used my best bitchy voice. "Not even like a sip of something? My throat's burning, practically on fire." My gaze flicked to Christian as I said those last few words, then returned to the guard who'd spoken. As expected, he rose from his seat and lurched toward me.
"Do not make me repeat myself," he growled.
I didn't know if he'd really do anything violent, but I had no interest in pushing it just yet. Besides, I'd accomplished my goal. If Christian couldn't take the hint, there was nothing else to be done for it. Hoping I looked afraid, I shut up. The guard returned to his seat, and after a while he stopped watching me. I looked at Christian again and gave the wrist tug. "Come on, come on," I thought. "Put it together, Christian." His eyebrows suddenly shot up, and he stared at me in amazement. Well, he'd apparently figured out something. I just hoped it was what I'd wanted. His look turned questioning, as though asking if I was really serious. I nodded emphatically. He frowned in thought for a few moments and then took a deep, steadying breath.
"All right,"
he said. Everyone jumped again.
"Shut up,"
said one of the guards automatically. He sounded weary.
"No," said Christian. "I'm ready. Ready to drink."
Everyone in the room froze for the space of a few heartbeats, including me. This wasn't exactly what I'd had in mind. The guard's leader stood up.
"Do not screw around with us."
"I'm not," said Christian. He had a feverish, desperate look on his face that I didn't think was entirely faked.
"I'm tired of this. I want to get out of here, and I don't want to die. I'll drink, and I want her."
He nodded toward me. Maya squeaked in alarm. Mason called Christian something that would have earned him a detention back at school. This definitely wasn't what I'd had in mind. The other two guards looked at their leader questioningly.
"Should we ask Isaiah?"
asked one of them.
"I don't think he's here,"
said the leader. He studied Christian for a few seconds and then made a decision.
"And I don't want to bother him anyway if this is a joke. Let him go, and we'll see."
One of the men produced a pair of sharp pliers. He moved behind Christian and leaned down. I heard the sound of plastic popping as the flex cuffs gave way. Grabbing a hold of Christian's arm, the guard jerked him upright and led him over to me.
"Christian!"
exclaimed Mason, fury filling his voice. He struggled against his constraints, shaking his chair a little.
"Are you out of your mind? Don't let them do this!" "You guys have to die, but I don't,"
snapped Christian, tossing his black hair out of his eyes.
"There's no other way out of this."
I really didn't know what was going on now, but I was pretty sure I should be showing a lot more emotion if I was about to die. Two guards flanked Christian on either side, watching warily as he leaned toward me.
"Christian,"
I whispered, surprised at how easy it was to sound afraid.
"Don't do this."
His lips twisted into one of the bitter smiles he produced so well.
"You and I have never liked each other, Rose. If I've got to kill someone, it might as well be you."
His words were icy, precise, believable. "Besides, I thought you wanted this."
"Not this. Please, don't."
One of the guards shoved Christian.
"Get it over with, or get back to your chair."
Still wearing that dark smile, Christian shrugged.
"Sorry, Rose. You're going to die anyway. Why not do it for a good cause?"
He brought his face down to my neck.
"This is probably going to hurt," he added.
I actually doubted it would. If he was really going to do it. Because he wasn't, right? I shifted uneasily. By all accounts, if you got all your blood sucked out of you, you also got enough endorphins pumped in during the process to dull most of the pain. It was like going to sleep. Of course, that was all speculation. People who died from vampire bites didn't really come back to report on the experience. Christian nuzzled my neck, moving his face under my hair so that it partially obscured him. His lips brushed my skin, every bit as soft as I recalled from when he and Lyssa kissed. A moment later, the points of his fangs touched my skin. And then I felt pain. Real pain. But it wasn't coming from the bite. His teeth only pressed against my skin. They didn't break it. His tongue moved against my neck in a lapping motion, but there was no blood to suck. If anything, it was more like some kind of weird, twisted kiss. No. The pain came from my wrists. A burning pain. Christian was using his magic to channel heat into my flex cuffs, just as I had wanted him to. He'd understood my message. The plastic grew hotter and hotter as he continued his barely there drinking. Anyone who'd been looking closely would have been able to tell he was half faking it, but too much of my hair was blocking the guard's view. I knew plastic was hard to melt, but only now did I really, really understand what that meant. The temperatures required to do any damage were off the charts. It was like plunging my hands into lava. The flex cuffs seared my skin, hot and terrible. I squirmed, hoping I could relieve the pain. I couldn't. What I did notice, however, was that the cuffs gave a little when I moved. They were getting softer. Okay, that was something. I just had to hold out a little longer. Desperately, I tried to focus on Christian's bite and distract myself. It worked for about 5 seconds. He wasn't giving me much in the way of endorphins, certainly not enough to combat that increasingly horrible pain. I whimpered, probably making myself more convincing.
"I can't believe it,"
muttered one of the guards. "He's actually doing it." Beyond them, I thought I heard the sound of Maya crying. The cuffs burning increased. I'd never felt anything so painful in my life, and I'd been through a lot. Passing out was rapidly becoming a very real possibility.
"Hey," the guard suddenly said, "what's that smell?"
That smell was melting plastic, or maybe my melting flesh. Honestly, it didn't matter, because the next time I moved my wrists, they broke through the gooey, scalding cuffs. I had 10 seconds of surprise, and I used them. I leapt out of my chair, pushing Christian backward in the process. He'd had a guard on either side of him, and one still held the pliers. In a single motion, I grabbed the pliers from the guy and plunged them into his cheek. He gave some kind of gurgled scream, but I didn't wait to see what happened. My window of surprise was closing, and I couldn't waste time. As soon as I let go of the pliers, I punched the second guy. My kicks were stronger than my punches, as a general rule, but I still hit him hard enough to startle him and make him stagger. By then, the guard's leader was in action. As I'd feared, he still had a gun, and he went for it.
"Don't move,"
he yelled, aiming at me. I froze. The guard I'd punched came forward and grabbed my arm. Nearby, the guy I'd stabbed was moaning on the floor. Still training the gun on me, the leader started to say something and then yelped in alarm. The gun glowed faintly orange and fell from his hands. Where he'd held it, the skin burned red and angry. Christian had heated the metal, I realized. Yeah, we definitely should have been using the magic thing from the start. If we got out of this, I was going to take up Tasha's cause. The Moroi anti-magic custom was so instilled in our brains that we hadn't even thought to try this sooner. It was stupid. I turned on the guy holding me. I don't think he expected a girl my size to put up so much of a fight. Plus, he was still kind of stunned over what happened to the other guy and the gun. I managed enough room to get in a kick to his stomach, a kick that would have earned me an A in my combat class. He grunted at the impact, and the motion propelled him back into the wall. In a flash, I was on him. Grabbing a fistful of his hair, I slammed his head against the ground hard enough to knock him out, but not kill him. Immediately, I sprang up, surprised the leader hadn't come after me yet. It shouldn't have taken him that long to recover from the shock of the heated gun, but when I turned around, the room was quiet. The leader lay unconscious on the ground, with a newly freed mason hovering over him. Nearby, Christian held the pliers in one hand and the gun in the other. It had to still be hot, but Christian's power must have made him immune. He was aiming at that man I'd stabbed. The guy wasn't unconscious, merely bleeding, but, like I had, he froze beneath that barrel. "Holy shit!" I muttered, taking in the scene. Staggering over to Christian, I held out my hand. "Give me that before you hurt somebody!" I expected a biting remark, but he simply handed the gun over with shaking hands. I shoved it into my belt. Studying him further, I saw how pale he was. He looked like he could collapse at any moment. He'd done some pretty major magic for someone who'd been starved for 2 days. "Mace, get the cuffs," I said. Without turning his back on the rest of us, Mason took a few steps back toward the box where our captors had kept their stash of flex cuffs. He pulled out 3 strips of plastic and then something else. With a questioning glance at me, he held up a roll of duct tape. "Perfect," I said. We bound our captors to the chairs. One had remained conscious, but we knocked him out too and then put duct tape over all their mouths. They'd eventually come to, and I didn't want them making any noise. After releasing Maya and Eddie, the 5 of us huddled together and planned our next move. Christian and Eddie could barely stand, but at least Christian was aware of his surroundings. Maya's face was streaked with tears, but I suspected she'd be able to take orders. That left Mason and me as the most functional in the group.
"That guy's watch says it's morning," he said. "All we've got to do is get outside, and they can't touch us. As long as there are no more humans, at least."
"They said Isaiah was gone," said Maya in a small voice. "We should just be able to leave, right?"
"Those men haven't left in hours," I said. "They could be wrong. We can't do anything stupid." Carefully, Mason opened the door to our room and peered out into the empty hallway.
"Think there's a way outside down here?"
"That'd make our lives easier," I muttered. I glanced back at the others.
"Stay here. We're going to check out the rest of the basement."
"What if somebody comes?" exclaimed Maya.
"They won't," I assured her.
I was actually pretty sure there was no one else in the basement. They would have come running with all that racket. And if anyone tried to come down the stairs, we would hear them first.
Still, Mason and I moved cautiously as we scouted around the basement, watching each other's backs and checking around corners. It was every bit the rat's maze I remembered from our initial capture. Twisted hallways and lots of rooms. One by one, we opened each door. Every room was empty, save for the occasional chair or two.
I shuddered, thinking that all of these were probably used as prisons, just as ours had been.
Not a goddamn window in this whole place,
I muttered when we finished our sweep.
We've got to go upstairs.
We headed back toward our room, but before we got there, Mason caught hold of my hand.
Rose.
I stopped and looked up at him.
Yeah?
His blue eyes, more serious than I'd ever seen them, looked down at me regretfully.
I really screwed things up.
I thought about all the events that had led to this. We screwed things up, Mason. He sighed.
I hope when all this is done, we can sit down and talk and figure things out. I shouldn't have gotten mad at you.
I wanted to tell him that that wasn't going to happen, that when he'd disappeared, I'd actually been on my way to tell him things wouldn't be better between us. Since this didn't seem like the right time or place to bring up a breakup, I lied. I squeezed his hand.
I hope so, too.
He smiled, and we returned to the others.
All right, I told them. Here's how it's going to be.
We quickly hashed out a plan and then crept up the stairs. I led, followed by Maya as she tried to support a reluctant Christian. Mason brought up the rear, practically dragging Eddie.
I should be first,
Mason murmured as we stood at the top of the stairs.
You aren't,
I snapped back, resting my hand on the doorknob.
Yeah, but if something happens...
Mason? I interrupted. I stared at him hard, and suddenly, I had a brief flash of my mother that day when the Drozdov attack had broken. Calm and controlled, even in the wake of something so horrible. They'd needed a leader, just like this group did now, and I tried as hard as I could to channel her. If something happens, you get them out of here. Run fast and run far. Do not come back without a herd of guardians.
You'll be the one who gets attacked first. What am I supposed to do?
He hissed.
Leave you?
Yes. You forget about me if you can get them out.
Rose, I'm not going to...
Mason? I again envisioned my mother, fighting for that strength and power to lead others. Can you do this or not? We stared at each other for several heavy moments while the others held their breaths.
I can do this,
he said stiffly. I nodded and turned back around. The basement door squeaked when I opened it, and I grimaced at the sound. Scarcely daring to breathe, I stood perfectly still at the top of the stairs, waiting and listening. The house and its eccentric decorating looked the same as when we'd been brought in. Dark blinds covered all of the windows, but along the edges I could see bright light peeping in. Sunshine had never tasted so sweet as it did at that moment. Getting to it meant freedom. There were no sounds, no movements. Looking around, I tried to remember where the front door was. It was on the other side of the house. Really not far in the grand scheme of things, but a gaping chasm at the moment. Scout with me, I whispered to Mason, hoping to make him feel better about bringing up the rear. He let Eddie lean on Maya for a moment and stepped forward with me to do a quick sweep of the main living area. Nothing. The path was clear from here to the front door. I exhaled in relief. Mason took hold of Eddie again, and we moved forward, all of us tense and nervous. God! We were going to do this, I realized. We were really going to do this. I couldn't believe how lucky we'd gotten. We'd been so close to disaster and had just barely made it through. It was one of those moments that made you appreciate your life and want to turn things around. A second chance you swear you won't let go to waste. A realization that... I heard them move almost at the same time I saw them step in front of us. It was like a magician conjured Isaiah and Elena out of thin air. Only, I knew there was no magic involved this time. Strigoi just moved that quickly. They must have been in one of the other main floor rooms that we assumed were empty. We hadn't wanted to waste the extra time looking. I raged at myself internally for not having checked out every inch of the whole floor. Somewhere, in the back of my memory, I heard myself taunting my mother in Stan's class. "It seems to me like you guys messed up. Why didn't you scope out the place and make sure it was clear of Strigoi in the first place? Seems like you could have saved yourself a lot of trouble." Karma's a real bitch.
"Children, children," crooned Isaiah. "This isn't how the game works. You're breaking the rules."
A cruel smile played over his lips. He found us amusing. No real threat at all. Honestly, he was right.
"Fast and far, Mason," I said in low voice, never taking my eyes off the Strigoi. "My, my. If looks could kill..."
Isaiah arched his eyebrows as something occurred to him.
"Are you thinking you can take us both on by yourself?"
He chuckled. Elena chuckled. I gritted my teeth. No, I didn't think I could take them both on. In fact, I was pretty sure I was going to die. But I was also pretty sure I could provide one hell of a distraction first. I lunged toward Isaiah and pulled the gun on Elena. You could get a jump on human guards, but not on Strigoi. They saw me coming practically before I even moved. They didn't expect me to have a gun, though. And while Isaiah blocked my attacking body with almost no effort whatsoever, I still managed to get a shot off at Elena before he seized my arms and restrained me. The gun's report rang loud in my ears, and she screamed in pain and surprise. I'd aimed for her stomach, but had been jostled into hitting her thigh. Not that it mattered. Not effort whatsoever. I still managed to get a shot off at Elena before he seized my arms and restrained me. The gun's report rang loud in my ears, and she screamed in pain and surprise. I'd aimed for her stomach, but had been jostled into hitting her thigh. Not that it mattered. Neither spot would kill her, but the stomach would have hurt a lot more. Isaiah held my wrists so hard I thought he'd break the bones. I dropped the gun. It hit the floor, bounced, and slid toward the door. Elena shrieked in rage and clawed at me. Isaiah told her to control herself and pushed me out of reach. All the while, I flailed as much as possible, not so much to escape as to make a nuisance of myself. And then, the sweetest of sounds, the front door opening. Mason had taken advantage of my distraction. He'd left Eddie with Maya and sprinted around me and the grappling Strigoi to open the door. Isaiah turned with that lightning-fast speed of his and screamed as sunlight poured over him. But even though he was suffering, his reflexes were still fast. He jerked himself out of the patch of light into the living room, dragging Elena and me with him. Her by the arm and me by my neck.
"Get them out!" I yelled.
"Isaiah!" began Elena, breaking out of his grip. He shoved me to the floor and spun around, staring at his escaping victims. I gasped for breath now that his grip on my throat was gone and peered back at the door through the tangle of my hair. I was just in time to see Mason drag Eddie over the threshold, out into the safety of the light. Maya and Christian were already gone. I nearly wept in relief. Isaiah turned back on me with all the fury of a storm, his eyes black and terrible as he loomed over me from his great height. His face, which had always been scary, became something almost beyond comprehension. Monstrous didn't even begin to cover it. He jerked me up by my hair. I cried out at the pain, and he brought his head down so that our faces were pressed up to one another's.
"You want a bite, girl?" he demanded. "You want to be a blood whore? Well, we can arrange that, in every sense of the word, and it will not be sweet. And it will not be numbing. It will be painful. Compulsion works both ways, you know, and I will make sure you believe you are suffering the worst pain of your life. And I will also make sure your death takes a very, very long time. You will scream.
You will cry. You will beg me to end it all and let you die.
Isaiah, cried Elena in exasperation. Just kill her already. If you'd done it sooner like I said, none of this would have happened.
He kept his grip on me but flicked his eyes toward her. Do not interrupt me.
You're being melodramatic, she continued.
Yeah, she really was whiny. I never would have thought a Strigoi could do that. It was almost comical.
And wasteful.
Do not talk back to me either, he said.
I'm hungry. I'm just saying you should let her go or I'll kill you.
We all turned at the new voice, a voice dark and angry. Mason stood in the doorway, framed in light, holding my dropped gun. Isaiah studied him for a few moments.
Sure, Isaiah finally said. He sounded bored. Try it.
Mason didn't hesitate. He fired and kept firing until he'd emptied the entire clip into Isaiah's chest. Each bullet made the Strigoi flinch a little, but otherwise, he kept standing and holding on to me. This was what it meant to be an old and powerful Strigoi, I realized. A bullet in the thigh hurt a young vampire like Elena. But for Isaiah, getting shot in the chest multiple times was simply a nuisance. Mason realized this too, and his features hardened as he threw down the gun.
Get out!
I screamed. He was still in the sun, still safe. But he didn't listen to me. He ran toward us, out of his protective light. I redoubled my struggles, hoping I'd pull Isaiah's attention away from Mason. I didn't. Isaiah shoved me into Elena before Mason was halfway to us. Swiftly, Isaiah blocked and seized hold of Mason, exactly as he'd done to me earlier. Only, unlike with me, Isaiah didn't restrain Mason's arms. He didn't jerk Mason upright by the hair or make long, rambling threats about agonizing death. Isaiah simply stopped the attack, grabbed Mason's head with both hands, and gave a quick twist. There was a sickening crack. Mason's eyes went wide. Then, they went blank. With an impatient sigh, Isaiah released his hold and tossed Mason's limp body over toward where Elena held me. It landed before us. My vision swam as nausea and dizziness wrapped around me.
There, Isaiah said to Elena. See if that'll tide you over. And save some for me.
Chapter 22. Horror and shock consumed me, so much so that I thought my soul would shrivel, that the world would end right then and there, because surely, surely it couldn't keep going on after this. No one could keep going on after this. I wanted to shriek my pain to the universe. I wanted to cry until I melted. I wanted to sink down beside Mason and die with him. Elena released me, apparently deciding I posed no danger positioned as I was between her and Isaiah. She turned toward Mason's body. And I stopped feeling. I simply acted.
Don't touch him.
I didn't recognize my own voice. She rolled her eyes.
Good grief, you're annoying. I'm starting to see Isaiah's point. You do need to suffer before dying.
Turning away, she knelt down to the floor and flipped Mason over onto his back.
Don't touch him! I screamed.
I shoved her with little effect. She shoved back, nearly knocking me over. It was all I could do to steady my feet and stay upright. Isaiah looked on with amused interest. Then his gaze fell to the floor. Lissa's tchotchke had fallen out of my coat pocket. He picked it up. Strigoi could touch holy objects. The stories of them fearing crosses weren't true. They just couldn't enter holy ground. He flipped the cross over and ran his fingers over the etched dragon.
Ah, the Dragomirs,
he mused. I'd forgotten about them.
Easy to. There's, what, one, two of them left?
Barely worth remembering.
Those horrible red eyes focused on me.
Do you know any of them?
I'll have to see to them one of these days.
It won't be very hard to.
Suddenly, I heard an explosion. The aquarium burst apart as water shot out of it, shattering the glass. Pieces of it flew toward me, but I barely noticed. The water coalesced in the air, forming a lopsided sphere. It began to float toward Isaiah. I felt my jaw drop as I stared at it. He watched it too, more puzzled than scared, at least until it wrapped around his face and started suffocating him. Much like the bullets, suffocation wouldn't kill him, but it could cause him a hell of a lot of discomfort. His hands flew to his face, desperately trying to pry the water away. It was no use. His fingers simply slipped through. Elena forgot about Mason and jumped to her feet.
"What is it?"
she shrieked. She shook him in an equally useless effort to free him.
"What's happening?"
Again, I didn't feel. I acted. My hand closed around a large piece of glass from the broken aquarium. It was jagged and sharp, cutting into my hand. Sprinting forward, I plunged the shard into Isaiah's chest, aiming for the heart I'd worked so hard to find in practice. Isaiah emitted a strangled scream through the water and collapsed to the floor. His eyes rolled back in his head, and he blacked out from the pain. Elena stared, as shocked as I'd been when Isaiah killed Mason. Isaiah wasn't dead, of course, but he was temporarily down for the count. Her face clearly showed she hadn't thought that was possible. The smart thing at that point would have been to run toward the door and the sun's safety. Instead, I ran in the opposite direction, toward the fireplace. I grabbed one of the antique swords and turned back toward Elena. I didn't have far to go, because she'd recovered herself and was heading toward me. Snarling with rage, she tried to grab me. I had never trained with a sword, but I had been taught to fight with any makeshift weapon I could find. I used the sword to keep distance between us, my motions clumsy but effective for the time being. White fangs flashed in her mouth.
"I am going to make you
suffer, pay, regret I was ever born," I suggested. I remembered fighting with my mom, how I'd been on the defensive the whole time. That wouldn't work this time. I had to attack. Jabbing forward, I tried to land a blow on Elena. No luck. She anticipated my every move. Suddenly, from behind her, Isaiah groaned as he started to come around. She glanced back. The smallest of motions that let me swipe the sword across her chest. It cut the fabric of her shirt and grazed the skin, but nothing more. Still, she flinched and looked down in panic. I think the glass going through Isaiah's heart was still fresh in her mind. And that was what I really needed. I mustered all my strength, drew back, and swung. The sword's blade hit the side of her neck, hard and deep. She gave a horrible, sickening cry, a shriek that made my skin crawl. She tried to move toward me. I pulled back and hit again. Her hands clutched at her throat, and her knees gave way. I struck and struck, the sword digging deeper into her neck each time. Cutting off someone's head was harder than I'd thought it would be. The old, dull sword probably wasn't helping. But finally, I gained enough sense to realize she wasn't moving. Her head lay there, detached from her body, her dead eyes looking up at me as though she couldn't believe what had happened. That made two of us. Someone was screaming, and for a surreal second, I thought it was still Elena. Then I lifted my eyes and looked across the room. Maya stood in the doorway, eyes bugging out and skin tinged green like she might throw up. Distantly, in the back of my mind, I realized she was the one who'd made the aquarium explode. Water magic apparently wasn't worthless after all. Still a bit shaken, Isaiah tried to rise to his feet, but I was on him before he could fully manage it. The sword sang out, reeking blood and pain with each blow. I felt like an old pro now. Isaiah fell back to the floor. In my mind, I kept seeing him break Mason's neck, and I hacked and hacked as hard as I could, as though striking fiercely enough might somehow banish the memory. Rose! Rose! Through my hate-filled haze, I just barely detected Maya's voice. Rose, he's dead! Slowly, shakily, I held back the next blow and looked down at his body, and the head no longer attached to it. She was right. He was dead. Very, very dead. I looked at the rest of the room. There was blood everywhere, but the horror of it didn't really register with me. My world had slowed down. Slowed down to two very simple tasks. Kill the Strigoi, protect Mason. I couldn't process anything else. Rose, whispered Maya. She was trembling, her words filled with fear. She was afraid of me, not the Strigoi. Rose, we have to go. Come on. I dragged my eyes away from her and looked down at Isaiah's remains. After several moments, I crawled over to Mason's body, still clutching the sword. No, I croaked out. I can't leave him. Other Strigoi might come. My eyes burned like I desperately wanted to cry. I couldn't say for sure. The bloodlust still pounded in me. Violence and rage the only emotions I was capable of anymore. Rose, we'll come back for him. If other Strigoi are coming, we have to get out. No, I repeated, not even looking at her. I'm not leaving him. I won't leave him alone. With my free hand, I stroked Mason's hair. Rose, I jerked my head up. Get out, I screamed at her. Get out and leave us alone. She took a few steps forward, and I lifted the sword. She froze. Get out, I repeated. Go find the others. Slowly, Maya backed up toward the door. She gave me one last, desperate look before running outside. Silence fell, and I relaxed my hold on the sword but refused to let it go. My body sagged forward, and I rested my head on Mason's chest. I became oblivious to everything, to the world around me, to time itself. Seconds could have passed, hours could have passed, I didn't know. I didn't know anything except that I couldn't leave Mason alone. I existed in an altered state, a state that just barely kept the terror and grief at bay. I couldn't believe Mason was dead. I couldn't believe I'd just summoned death. So long as I refused to acknowledge either, I could pretend they hadn't happened. Footsteps and voices eventually sounded, and I lifted my head up. People poured in through the door, lots of them. I couldn't really make out any of them. I didn't need to. They were threats. Threats I had to keep Mason safe from. A couple of them approached me, and I leapt up, lifting the sword and holding it protectively over his body. Stay back, I warned. Stay away from him. They kept coming. Stay back, I yelled. They stopped, except for one. Rose, came a soft voice. Drop the sword. My hands shook. I swallowed. Get away from us. Rose, the voice spoke again. A voice that my soul would have known anywhere. Hesitantly, I let myself finally become aware of my surroundings, let the details sink in. I let my eyes focus on the features of the man standing there. Dimitri's brown eyes, gentle and firm, looked down on me. It's okay, he said. Everything's going to be okay. You can let go of the sword.
My hands shook even harder as I fought to hold on to the hilt. I can't. The words hurt coming out. I can't leave him alone. I have to protect him.
You have, said Dimitri.
The sword fell out of my hands, landing with a loud clatter on the wooden floor. I followed, collapsing on all fours, wanting to cry, but still unable to. Dimitri's arms wrapped around me as he helped me up. Voices swarmed around us, and one by one I recognized people I knew and trusted. He started to tug me toward the door, but I refused to move just yet. I couldn't. My hands clutched his shirt, crumpling the fabric. Still keeping one arm around me, he smoothed my hair back away from my face. I leaned my head against him, and he continued stroking my hair, murmuring something in Russian. I didn't understand a word of it, but the gentle tone soothed me. Guardians were spreading throughout the house, examining it inch by inch. A couple of them approached us and knelt by the bodies I refused to look at.
She did that? Both of them? That sword hasn't been sharpened in years.
A funny sound caught in my throat. Dimitri squeezed my shoulder comfortingly.
Get her out of here, Belikov,
I heard a woman say behind him, her voice familiar. Dimitri squeezed my shoulder again.
Come on, Rosa. It's time to go.
This time, I went. He guided me out of the house, holding on to me as I managed each agonizing step. My mind still refused to really process what had happened. I couldn't do much more than follow simple directions from those around me. I eventually ended up on one of the Academy's jets. Engines roared around us as the plane lifted off. Dimitri murmured something about coming back shortly and left me alone in my seat. I stared straight ahead, studying the details of the seat in front of me. Someone sat beside me and draped a blanket over my shoulders. I noticed then just how badly I was shivering. I tugged at the edges of the blanket.
I'm cold, I said. How am I so cold?
You're in shock, Maya answered. I turned and looked at her, studying her blonde curls and big blue eyes. Something about seeing her unleashed my memories. It all tumbled back. I squeezed my eyes shut.
Oh, God,
I breathed. I opened my eyes and focused on her again.
You saved me. Saved me when you blew up the fish tank. You shouldn't have done it. You shouldn't have come back.
She shrugged.
You shouldn't have gone for the sword.
Fair point.
Thank you,
I told her. What you did. I never would have thought of that. It was brilliant.
I don't know about that, she mused, smiling ruefully. Water isn't much of a weapon, remember?
I choked on a laugh, even though I really didn't find my old words that funny. Not anymore.
Water's a great weapon, I said finally.
When we get back, we'll have to practice ways to use it. Her face lit up. Fierceness shone out from her eyes.
I'd like that. More than anything.
I'm sorry. Sorry about your mom. Maya simply nodded.
You're lucky to still have yours.
You don't know how lucky. I turned and stared at the seat again. The next words out of my mouth startled me. I wish she was here.
She is,
said Maya, sounding surprised.
She was with the group that raided the house. Didn't you see her?
I shook my head. We lapsed into silence. Maya stood up and left. A minute later, someone else sat down beside me. I didn't have to see her to know who she was. I just knew.
Rose, said my mother.
For once in my life, she sounded unsure of herself. Scared, maybe.
Maya said you wanted to see me.
I didn't answer. I didn't look at her.
What? What do you need?
I didn't know what I needed. I didn't know what to do. The stinging in my eyes grew unbearable, and before I knew it, I was crying. Big, painful sobs seized my body.
The tears I'd held back so long poured down my face. The fear and grief I'd refused to let myself feel finally burst free, burning in my chest. I could scarcely breathe. My mother put her arms around me, and I buried my face in her chest, sobbing even harder.
"I know," she said softly, tightening her grip on me. "I understand."
Chapter 23. The weather warmed up on the day of my Molniya ceremony. In fact, it was so warm that a lot of the snow on campus began melting, running down the sides of the academy's stone buildings in slim, silvery streams. Winter was far from being over, so I knew everything would just freeze up again in a few days. For now, though, it felt as though the entire world was weeping. I had walked away from the Spokane incident with minor bruises and cuts. The burns from the melting flex cuffs were the worst of my injuries, but I was still having a hard time dealing with the death I'd caused and the death I'd seen. I'd wanted little more than to go curl up in a ball somewhere and not talk to anyone, except maybe Lissa. But on my fourth day back at the academy, my mother had found me and told me it was time to receive my marks. It had taken me several moments to grasp what she was talking about. Then it occurred to me that in decapitating two Strigoi, I'd earned two Molniya tattoos. My first ones. The realization had stunned me. All my life, in considering my future career as a guardian, I'd looked forward to the marks. I'd seen them as badges of honor. But now? Mainly they were going to be reminders of something I wanted to forget. The ceremony took place in the Guardian's building, in a large room they used for meetings and banquets. It was nothing at all like the great dining room at the resort. It was efficient and practical, like the Guardians were. The carpet was a bluish-gray shade, low and tightly woven. The bare white walls held framed black-and-white photos of St. Vladimir's through the years. There were no other decorations or fanfare, yet the solemnity and power of the moment were palpable. All the Guardians on campus, but no novices, attended. They milled around the building's main meeting room, hanging out in clusters but not talking. When the ceremony started, they fell into orderly ranks without being told and watched me. I sat on a stool in the corner of the room, leaning forward, with my hair hanging over the front of my face. Behind me, a guardian named Lionel held a tattooist's needle to the back of my neck. I'd known him the whole time I'd been at the academy, but I'd never realized he was trained to draw Molniya marks. Before he started, he had a murmured conversation with my mother and Alberta.
"She won't have a promise mark," he said. "She hasn't graduated."
"It happens," said Alberta. "She made the kills. Do the Molniyas, and she'll get the promise mark later." Considering the pain I regularly put myself through, I didn't expect the tattoos to hurt as much as they did. But I bit my lip and stayed silent as Lionel made the marks. The process seemed to go on forever. When he finished, he produced a couple of mirrors, and with some maneuvering, I was able to see the back of my neck. Two tiny black marks sat there, side by side, against my reddened and sensitive skin. Molniya meant lightning in Russian, and that's what the jagged shape was meant to symbolize. Two marks, one for Isaiah, one for Elena. Once I'd seen them, he bandaged them up and gave me some instructions about caring for them while they healed. Most of it I missed, but I figured I could ask again later. I was still kind of shocked by it all. After that, all the gathered guardians came up to me one by one. They each gave me some sort of sign of affection, a hug, a kiss on the cheek, and kind words. "Welcome to the ranks," said Alberta, her weathered face gentle as she pulled me into a tight embrace. Dimitri didn't say anything when his turn came, but as always, his eyes spoke legions. Pride and tenderness filled his expression, and I swallowed back tears. He rested one hand gently on my cheek, nodded, and walked away. When Stan, the instructor I'd fought with the most since my first day, hugged me and said,
"Now you're one of us.
I always knew you'd be one of the best.
I thought I'd pass out. And then, when my mother came up to me, I couldn't help the tear that ran down my cheek. She wiped it away and then brushed her fingers against the back of my neck.
Don't ever forget, she told me.
Nobody said, congratulations, and I was glad. Death wasn't anything to get excited about. When that was done, drinks and food were served. I walked to the buffet table and made a plate for myself of miniature feta quiches and a slice of mango cheesecake. I ate without really tasting the food and answered questions from others without even knowing what I said half the time. It was like I was a rose robot going through the motions of what was expected. On the back of my neck, my skin stung from the tattoos, and in my mind, I kept seeing Mason's blue eyes and Isaiah's red ones. I felt guilty for not enjoying my big day more, but I was relieved when the group finally started dispersing. My mother walked up to me as others murmured their goodbyes. Aside from her words here at the ceremony, we hadn't talked much since my breakdown on the plane. I still felt a little funny about that, and a little embarrassed as well. She'd never mentioned it, but something very small had shifted in the nature of our relationship. We weren't anywhere near being friends, but we weren't exactly enemies anymore either. Lord Seltsky is leaving soon, she told me as we stood near the building's doorway, not far from where I'd yelled for her on the first day we talked. I'll be going with him. I know, I said. There was no question she'd leave. That was how it was. Guardians followed Maroi. They came first. She regarded me for a few moments, her brown eyes thoughtful. For the first time in a long time, I felt like we were actually looking eye to eye, as opposed to her looking down on me. It was about time, too, seeing as I had a half a foot of height on her.
You did well, she said at last, considering the circumstances.
It was only half a compliment, but I deserved no more. I understood now the mistakes and lapses of judgment that had led to the events at Isaiah's house. Some had been my fault. Some hadn't. I wished I could have changed some of my actions, but I knew she was right. I'd done the best I could in the end with the mess before me. Killing Strigoi wasn't as glamorous as I thought it'd be, I told her. She gave me a sad smile.
No, it never is.
I thought then about all the marks on her neck, all the kills. I shuddered. Oh, hey. Eager to change the subject, I reached into my pocket and pulled out the little blue eye pendant she'd given me. This thing you gave me, it's a Nazar? I stumbled over the word. She looked surprised.
Yes. How'd you know?
I didn't want to explain my dreams with Adrian. Someone told me. It's a protection thing, right? A pensive look crossed her face, and then she exhaled and nodded.
Yes. It comes from an old superstition in the Middle East. Some people believe that those who want to hurt you can curse you or give you the evil eye. The Nazar is meant to counteract the evil eye, and just bring protection in general to those who wear it.
I ran my finger over the piece of glass. Middle East, so places sort of like, Turkey? My mother's lips quirked.
Places exactly like Turkey.
She hesitated.
It was a gift. A gift I received a long time ago.
Her gaze turned inward, lost in memory.
I got a lot of attention from men when I was your age. Attention that seemed flattering at first, but wasn't in the end. It's hard to tell the difference sometimes between what's real affection and what's someone wanting to take advantage of you. But when you feel the real thing, well, you'll know.
I understood then why she was so overprotective about my reputation. She'd endangered her own when she was younger. Maybe more than that had been damaged. I also knew why she'd given the Nazar to me. My father had given it to her. I didn't think she wanted to talk any more about it, so I didn't ask. It was enough to know that maybe, just maybe,
Their relationship hadn't been all about business and jeans, after all. We said goodbye, and I returned to my classes. Everyone knew where I'd been that morning, and my fellow novices wanted to see my Molniya marks. I didn't blame them. If our roles had been reversed, I would have been harassing me, too.
"Come on, Rose," begged Shane Reyes.
We were walking out of our morning practice, and he kept swatting my ponytail. I made a mental note to wear my hair down tomorrow. Several others followed us and echoed his requests.
"Yeah, come on. Let's see what you got for your swordsmanship."
Their eyes shone with eagerness and excitement. I was a hero. Their classmate who dispatched the leaders of the roving band of Strigoi that had so terrorized us over the holidays. But I met the eyes of someone standing at the back of the group. Someone who looked neither eager nor excited. Eddie. Meeting my gaze, he gave a small, sad smile. He understood. "Sorry, guys," I said, turning back to the others. "They have to stay bandaged. Doctor's orders." This was met with grumbles that soon turned into questions about how I'd actually killed the Strigoi. Decapitation was one of the hardest and rarest ways to kill a vampire. It wasn't like carrying a sword was convenient, so I did my best to tell my friends what had happened, making sure to stick to the facts and not glorify the killings. The school day couldn't end a moment too soon, and Lissa walked with me back to my dorm. She and I hadn't had the chance to talk much since everything had gone down in Spokane. I'd undergone a lot of questioning, and then there'd been Mason's funeral. Lissa had also been caught up in her own distractions with the Royals leaving campus, so she'd had no more free time than me. Being near her made me feel better. Even though I could be in her head at any time, it just wasn't the same as actually being physically around another living person who cared about you. When we got to the door of my room, I saw a bouquet of freesias sitting on the floor near it. Sighing, I picked up the fragrant flowers without even looking at the attached card.
"What are those?" asked Lissa while I unlocked the door.
"They're from Adrian," I told her. We walked inside, and I pointed to my desk, where a few other bouquets sat. I put the freesias down beside them. "I'll be glad when he leaves campus. I don't think I can take much more of this." She turned to me in surprise.
You don't know."
I got that warning twinge through the bond that told me I wouldn't like what was about to come.
"Know what?"
"He isn't leaving. He's going to stay here for a while."
"He has to leave," I argued.
To my knowledge, the only reason he'd come back at all was because of Mason's funeral, and I still wasn't sure why he'd done that, since he barely knew Mason. Maybe Adrian had just done it for show, or maybe to keep stalking Lissa and me.
"He's in college, or maybe reform school, I don't know, but he does something."
"He's taking the semester off." I stared. Smiling at my shock, she nodded. "He's going to stay and work with me, and Miss Carmack." All this time, he never even knew what spirit was. He just knew he hadn't specialized, but that he had these weird abilities. He just kept them to himself, except for when he occasionally found another spirit user. But they didn't know any more than he did.
"I should have figured it out sooner," I mused. "There was something about being around him. I always wanted to talk to him, you know? He just has this charisma, like you do. I guess it's all tied into spirit and compulsion or whatever. It makes me like him, even though I don't like him."
"Don't you?" she teased.
"No," I replied adamantly. "And I don't like that dream thing either."
Her jade eyes went wide with wonder. "That is cool," she said. "You've always been able to tell what's going on with me, but I've never been able to communicate with you the other way. I'm glad you guys got away when you did. But I wish I could have figured out the dream thing and helped find you."
"Not me," I said. "I'm glad Adrian didn't get you to go off your meds."
I hadn't found that out until a few days after being in Spokane. Lyssa had apparently rejected Adrian's initial suggestion that stopping the pills would let her learn more about Spirit. She had admitted to me later, however, that if Christian and I had stayed missing much longer, she might have cracked. "How are you feeling lately?" I asked, recalling her concerns about the medication. "You still feel like the pills aren't working?"
Well, it's hard to explain. I still feel closer to the magic, like maybe they aren't blocking me so much anymore. But I'm not feeling any of the other mental side effects, not upset or anything.
Wow, that's great. A beautiful smile lit her face.
I know. It makes me think there might be hope for me to learn to work the magic after all, someday.
Seeing her so happy made me smile back. I hadn't liked seeing those dark feelings starting to return, and was glad they'd vanished. I didn't understand the how or the why, but as long as she felt okay.
Everyone has light around them, except for you. You have shadows. You take them from Lyssa.
Adrian's words slammed into my mind. Uneasily, I thought about my behavior these last couple of weeks. Some of the angry outbursts, my rebelliousness, unusual even for me, my own black coil of emotion stirring in my chest. No, I decided. There were no similarities. Lyssa's dark feelings were magic-based. Mine were stress-based. Besides, I felt fine right now. Seeing her watching me, I tried to remember where we'd left off in the conversation. Maybe you'll eventually find a way to make it work. I mean, if Adrian could find a way to use Spirit and doesn't need meds. She suddenly laughed.
You don't know, do you?
What?
That Adrian does medicate himself.
He does, but he said... I groaned. Of course he does. The cigarettes, the drinking, God only knows what else.
She nodded.
Yep. He's almost always got something in his system. But probably not at night, which is why he can poke his head into my dreams.
Man, I wish I could do that, she sighed.
Maybe you'll learn someday. Just don't become an alcoholic in the process.
I won't, she assured me. But I will learn. None of the other Spirit users could do it.
Rose, well, aside from St. Vladimir, I'll learn like he did. I'm going to learn to use it, and I won't let it hurt me. I smiled and touched her hand. I had absolute faith in her.
I know.
We talked for most of the evening. When the time came for my usual practice with Dimitri, I parted ways with her. As I walked away, I pondered something that had been bothering me. Although the attacking groups of Strigoi had had many more members, the Guardians felt confident Isaiah had been their leader. That didn't mean there wouldn't be other threats in the future, but they felt it'd be a while before his followers regrouped. But I couldn't help thinking about the list I'd seen in the tunnel in Spokane, the one that had listed royal families by size. And Isaiah had mentioned the Dragomirs by name. He knew they were almost gone, and he'd sounded keen on being the one to finish them. Sure, he was dead now. But were there other Strigoi out there with the same idea? I shook my head. I couldn't worry about that. Not today. I still needed to recover from everything else. Soon, though. Soon, I'd have to deal with this. I didn't even know if our practice was still on, but went to the locker room anyway. After changing into practice clothes, I headed down into the gym and found Dimitri in a supply room, reading one of the Western novels he loved. He looked up at my entrance. I'd seen little of him in these last few days, and had figured he was busy with Tasha.
"I thought you might come by," he said, putting a bookmark between the pages.
"It's time for practice." He shook his head.
"No, no practice today. You still need to recover."
"I've got a clean bill of health. I'm good to go."
I pushed as much patented Rose Hathaway bravado into my words as I could.
Dimitri wasn't falling for any of it. He gestured to the chair beside him.
"Sit down, Rose."
I hesitated only a moment before complying. He moved his own chair close to mine so that we sat directly across from each other.
My heart fluttered as I looked into those gorgeous dark eyes.
No one gets over their first kills, easily, even with Strigoi.
Well, it's still technically taking a life. That's hard to come to terms with.
And after everything else you went through.
He sighed, then reached out and caught my hand in his. His fingers were exactly like I remembered, long and powerful, calloused with years of training.
When I saw your face, when we found you in that house, you can't imagine how I felt.
I swallowed. How? How did you feel?
Devastated. Grief-stricken. You were alive, but the way you looked, I didn't think you'd ever recover. And it tore me apart to think of that happening to you so young.
He squeezed my hand.
You will recover. I know that now. And I'm glad. But you aren't there.
Not yet.
Losing someone you care about is never easy.
My eyes dropped from his and studied the floor. It's my fault, I said in a small voice.
Hmm?
Mason, getting killed. I didn't have to see Dimitri's face to know compassion was filling it.
Oh, Rosa. No. You made some bad decisions. You should have told others when you knew he was gone. But you can't blame yourself. You didn't kill him.
Tears brimmed in my eyes as I looked back up. I might as well have. The whole reason he went there, it was my fault. We had a fight. And I told him about the Spokane thing, even though you asked me not to. One tear leaked out of the corner of my eye. Really, I needed to learn to stop that. Just as my mother had. Dimitri delicately wiped the tear off my cheek.
You can't blame yourself for that,
he told me.
You can regret your decisions and wish you'd done things differently. But in the end, Mason made his decisions too. That was what he chose to do. It was his decision in the end, no matter your original role.
When Mason had come back for me, I realized he'd let his feelings for me get in the way. It was what Dimitri had always feared, that if he and I had any sort of relationship, it would put us and any Maroi we protected in danger. I just wish I'd been able to, I don't know, do anything. Swallowing back further tears, I pulled my hands from Dimitri's and stood up before I could say something stupid. I should go, I said thickly. Let me know when you want to start practice again. And thanks for talking. I started to turn, then I heard him say abruptly,
No.
I glanced back. What? He held my gaze, and something warm and wonderful and powerful shot between us.
No,
he repeated.
I told her no. Tasha.
I shut my mouth before my jaw hit the floor. But why? That was a once-in-a-lifetime thing. You could have had a baby, and she was, you know, into you. The ghost of a smile flickered on his face.
Yes, she was. Is. And that's why I had to say no. I couldn't return that. Couldn't give her what she wanted. Not when...
He took a few steps toward me.
Not when my heart is somewhere else.
I almost started crying again. But you seemed so into her, and you kept going on about how young I acted.
You act young,
he said.
Because you are young. But you know things, Rosa. Things people older than you don't even know. That day?
I knew instantly which day he referred to. The one up against the wall.
You were right about how I fight to stay in control. No one else has ever figured that out, and it scared me. You scare me.
Why? Don't you want anyone to know? He shrugged.
Whether they know the fact or not doesn't matter. What matters is that someone, that you, know me that well. When a person can see into your soul, it's hard. It forces you to be open. vulnerable. It's much easier being with someone who's just more of a casual friend.
Like Tasha.
Tasha Ozera is an amazing woman. She's beautiful, and she's brave. But she doesn't...
She doesn't get you. I finished. He nodded.
I knew that. But I still wanted the relationship. I knew it would be easy and that she could take me away from you. I thought she could make me forget you.
I'd thought the same thing about Mason. But she couldn't.
Yes. And so, that's a problem.
Because it's wrong for us to be together?
Yes.
Because of the age difference?
Yes.
But more importantly, because we're going to be Liz's guardians and need to focus on her, not each other.
Yes.
I thought about this for a moment and then looked straight into his eyes. Well, I said at last, the way I see it, we aren't Liz's guardians yet. I steeled myself for the next response. I knew it was going to be one of those Zen life lessons, something about inner strength and perseverance, about how the choices we made today were templates for the future or some other nonsense. Instead, he kissed me. Time stopped as he reached out and cupped my face between his hands. He brought his mouth down and brushed it against my lips. It was barely a kiss at first, but soon increased, becoming heady and deep. When he finally pulled away, it was to kiss my forehead. He left his lips there for several seconds as his arms held me close. I wished the kiss could have gone on forever. Breaking the embrace, he ran a few fingers through my hair and down my cheek. He stepped back toward the door.
I'll see you later, Rosa.
At our next practice? I asked. We are starting those up again, right? I mean, you still have things to teach me? Standing in the doorway, he looked over at me and smiled. Yes, lots of things.
This has been an Audible.com and Penguin Young Readers Group production. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 2008 by Rochelle Mead. Audio recording copyright 2008 by Penguin Group USA Incorporated.
Audible Kids hopes you have enjoyed.